quite a week for us church-wise. So we ended up not having school Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, so we were back 2 days and had some sick teachers, and of course, they're just, as I talked, there were just so many people sick, and we didn't do church Wednesday, so I hope that everybody got that message. I thought about coming down just to make sure, but I did not, so. Deuteronomy 25 is where we will begin this morning. It is good to have you here. Just a couple of things to mention. Of course, if you did not see it, congratulations are in order to Aaron and Jessica Clemson. They have a little baby Wednesday. And if you did not see it, Dan Williams' mom passed away this morning. And so Dan had gone down there last week. She had taken a fall, and they had done some surgery, and she never really fully regained consciousness, or for a very brief time. And so, anyway. And then, of course, we are still dealing with some pretty widespread illness and a little bit of COVID, and folks are kind of quarantining for that. So it is good to have you here, and let's pray. And we will begin our study this morning. Father, thank you for your grace, and we pray for your abundant grace upon all who are physically suffering, mentally suffering this day, all who are sick and all who are sad. And we thank you for the warm reception that you have given to us. And we thank you that there is healing and help in you. We pray your blessing upon all of your people and wherever they might be on this, your day. And we do pray, Lord, that you would be honored this day. Help us to be good students of your word. And we ask your help in our Sunday school class. In Jesus' name, amen. So Deuteronomy 25 is where we are this morning. So just, a couple of things to orient us. I had mentioned that, I periodically get some questions. I am certainly not the fount of all knowledge and wisdom, and so I thought maybe we would just find some benefit in Sunday school just to tackle those questions. They're things that obviously have concerned some people, and so wanted to touch base on them. And one of them we talked about last week, which was the, God's toleration. And I don't know if there's any, as a minimum, God's toleration of polygamy and what that might mean to us. And my intention really was to just deal with that. I thought we could address it, and I thought that we could move on from there, and that would be the end of it. But I received a couple of additional questions in light of it, and so I thought that we should come back and look at least at those kind of follow-up questions. And so Deuteronomy 25 is our passage where we will begin. And again, I got two things I want to try and address this morning, so I'm just going to move relatively quickly if I can. Okay, so Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 through 10. Let's look at them. If brethren dwell together and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife, and performs the duty of an husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn which he beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. And if the man like not to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate unto the elders, and say, my husband's brother refuseth to raise up unto his brother a name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak unto him, and if he stand to it and say, I like not to take her, then shall his brother's wife come unto him in the presence of the elders, loose his shoe from off his foot, and spit in his face, and shall answer and say, so shall it be done unto the man that will not build up his brother's house, and his name shall be called in Israel the house of him that hath his shoe loosed. So this is a passage in the law, obviously the law of Moses, that deals with what we know as levirate marriage, L-E-V-I-R-A-T-E, not having anything to do with Levi, but actually coming from a Latin word that refers to husband's brother, which the Bible calls him the husband's brother. We would call him the brother-in-law. Right? So we're talking here about the legal responsibility of the brother-in-law with reference to his dead brother. The purpose of this law is found in verse number 6. I mean, why do we have this? And there are two reasons, I think, that function here kind of in tandem. But the reason for this levirate marriage, okay, and we'll come back to the particulars, but I mean, you can read it. You've kind of figured it out for yourself, right? The purpose is, verse number 6, it shall be that the firstborn which she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother, which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. Okay, this concept of levirate marriage, and I don't want to get too far afield here, is actually very common in the world. And it occurs primarily in cultures in which marriage outside of a particular clan or tribal relationship is prohibited. Exogamous marriages, which is something that we don't practice in America. Right? I mean, in America, you know, you are pretty much free these days, pretty much free to marry anybody. And we're not really talking even so much about legal restrictions as we are about cultural restrictions. So, right? So Israel, of course, was 12 tribes. And so your responsibility was to marry within your tribe. And all of this had to do with the allocation of the land and those kinds of divisions. And so in cultures, and if you went to Wikipedia and looked up levirate marriage, you would find a lengthy article that maps out the practices of levirate marriage in many cultures in history. Again, cultures that tend to view themselves as kind of tribal or clannish in that way, where you are expected to marry within a very limited pool of people. Okay, the purpose of the law, to go back to what I'd said, is that his name be not put out of Israel. Right? The man dies and there's no child, and so there's no succession of his family name. When he dies and having no male heir, then that's just going to be the end of the line, and we simply do not want that, right? In the world of Israel, in the allotment of the land and the allotment of the tribes, we want to keep the family names alive and perpetuated through a male heir. Okay? So the main purpose is the preservation of a lineage or descendants. But an additional purpose is, maybe not a purpose, but part of this is to legitimize and to legalize what is otherwise an illicit relationship under the law of Moses. Take a minute, if you would, and turn back to Leviticus chapter 18. All right, let's just look at, first of all, at verse number 6, Leviticus 18:6. None of you shall approach to any that is near of kin to him to uncover their nakedness. I am the Lord. And we understand, of course, to uncover their nakedness is being used euphemistically there. Right? So physical relationships between close kin are banned. Specifically down to verse number 16. Thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of thy brother's wife. It is thy brother's nakedness. Now again, a lot of these things read a little weird, perhaps, to us. And, you know, we are, for better or worse, politically advanced enough to be more enlightened about women's rights and their role. But they really very much were viewed in the kind of property sense. And the wife certainly in many ways belonged to her husband. And so that's why it's explained that way, right? She belongs to her husband, and for a man, for even a brother-in-law to engage in a sexual relationship with her is to violate not only her, but to violate the very brother. So this is something that you cannot do, right? This is the law of Moses. This is the law of God. You cannot have that relationship. But if this particular set of circumstances happens, then that part of the law is set aside. And actually, as we'll see, there is literally a mandate that you take up this kind of relationship. All right, so verses 5 and 6, then, to go back to Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 and 6 set up for us the scenario. What are the events that have to happen? Okay, number one, if brothers dwell together, which generally speaking does not mean that they lived in the same house, but that they are living in the same, right, within the same clan unit. For instance, if they were of the tribe of Levi, they would both be living within the land. Well, Levi's bad because Levi doesn't get land. If they are both of the tribe of Reuben, then they're going to be living within the tribal allotment of Reuben's land, and probably in even closer proximity than that. And I think that the implication is not only a geographical proximity, but a spiritual kind of proximity. Right? These are two men under the law of Moses sharing the same idea. So back to verse number 5. So if brethren dwell together and one of them dies, right? So we have brothers who are living together. One of the brothers dies and he has no child. All right. And specifically, this is one of those places where I wish the King James had dealt with this. Specifically, we are talking about a boy. The Hebrew word there is actually the word ben, which means son. Right? So again, back to verse number 5, if brothers dwell together, one of them dies and has no son. Right? So there's no male heir. Right? That's where we get to verse number 6. Then his widow, verse number 5, shall not marry without unto a stranger. So she is not allowed to marry outside the clan. She is not allowed to marry outside the tribe of Israel. And I'm not going to take you to the passage, but Leviticus 22, verses 10 through 13, teaches that that kind of marriage is not always prohibited. In other words, there is a provision, even under the law of Moses, to marry an outsider. There is a provision to marry somebody who is not an Israelite. But here is a widow, and we're going to operate, right? The text doesn't say, but we're going to operate under the assumption that she is young enough to bear children, and her husband dies, and she has no son, then she is specifically enjoined from marrying an outsider, right? Because we want to preserve the name of that family under that tribal identity. Then here's what will happen. Verse number 5, her husband's brother shall go in unto her, and take her to him to wife, and perform the duty of an husband's brother unto her. And we talked about that last week with reference to the law and wife number 2, the duty of marriage, which obviously, folks, I think you could go, well, what is the duty of marriage? Well, verse number 6 is pretty explicit in helping you to understand what the duty of marriage is. And it shall be that the firstborn which she beareth. Right? And one of the guys that I read in his commentary on this said, well, this is a marriage, but it's not a real marriage. And I just, for the life of me, could not figure out what could possibly make it more of a real marriage than having kids together. So she may not marry outside, but what is supposed to happen is that her brother-in-law is supposed to marry her, and they are supposed to have children together so that this children, this family line will continue. And by the way, we see some reflection of that kind of mentality in Genesis chapter 38 with Judah and his relationship and those kinds of sons. And it, and we see it a little bit in the book of Ruth with the idea of the kinsman redeemer. Okay. So there's the scenario. All right. So, I mean, seriously, right? I'm not trying to be coarse and I'm not trying to be humorous, but right, ladies, here's the law of the land of the United States of America. If your husband dies, you have to marry his brother. Specifically, right? Because we're going to flip it here to make sure we get it right. If your husband dies, your brother-in-law has to marry you. He has to marry you. That's the law of the land. This is what God wants to happen. If your husband dies, his brother will become your husband. Verses 7 through 10 address some of the potential problems that you will encounter within the, might encounter in making this thing go, right? Even in that relatively primitive world, even in a world in which ideally everybody lines up to do the will of the Lord from the heart with a smile on their face, we may find ourselves, verse number 7, if the man like not to take his brother's wife. Right? So here's the custom. Here's the law of Moses. Right? This factors into, right, from the, right, this is just part of the fabric of society. That, right? Right? I mean, it's your wedding day and it's an exciting day and you're going to get married and your brother is your best man. And part of the conversation is, you know, if anything happens to me, you have to marry her. You have to marry her. But if the man like not to take his brother's wife, verse number 7. And there are no reasons given for that refusal. Right? The word like there means pleased. If the man is not pleased to take his brother's wife. And again, we are just, I mean, if you just go to the literature on this, right? We are just still trying to understand what is driving this. Is it the fact that he finds her unappealing? Is it the fact that his existing wife, and we will come to that, that his existing wife is going, there is no chance in the world that this is going to happen. Is it an economic factor? We do not know, right? All we know is this, right? If the man finds no pleasure in this, if he says, I do not want to do this, okay? Then here's what happens. Verse number 7. Then let his brother's wife go up to the gate unto the elders. All right, now we don't want to, right? We want to read this again within the right framework. What we have here, folks, now are the beginnings of legal proceedings. This is going to work its way through the courts, so to speak. She's a widow. And her brother-in-law says, I'm not marrying you. All right? Then she goes to the officials and she lodges her official complaint. Verse number 7, my husband's brother refuseth to raise up unto his brother a name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak unto him. Right? So now he's going to be summoned to court, in effect. And he's going to be called to testify. And if he stand to it and say, I like not to take her, if he holds his ground, right? I mean, right, we have the kind of this informal scenario. You have to marry your sister-in-law. I'm not marrying my sister-in-law. All right, then she goes to the officials who do not say, this is a stupid thing. Whoever heard of such a stupid thing? Marrying your brother-in-law, they issue an official summons. The brother-in-law is summoned to court. And they say, are you refusing to marry your sister-in-law? And he says, yes, I'm refusing to marry my sister-in-law. I will not do it. Verse number 9, Then shall his brother's wife come unto him in the presence of the elders, and loose his shoe from off his foot, and spit in his face, and shall answer and say, so shall it be done unto the man that will not build up his brother's house. So, right? So then what happens in verses 9 and 10, and his name shall be called in Israel the house of him that hath his shoe loosed. Right? The legal process is not some way of forcing the marriage upon him. The legal solution is a form of public humiliation upon the man. She removes his shoe. And you can find this removal of the shoe in other Old Testament passages. It's part of the formal proceedings, legal proceedings that existed in the world at that time. You didn't go to the county courthouse. You went to the gate of the city. And there sitting in the gate were the ruling elders, the senior governmental officials, the case hearers, the decision makers. And you pled your case. And she removes his sandal and she spits in his face. And then this is entered, in a sense, into the public record in verse number 10. His name shall be called in Israel the house of him that hath his shoe loose. This becomes a part of his criminal record. Right? He is tarnished with this brush from the government officials. Here is the man who will not do his duty. Here's the man who will not do his duty. This is his responsibility. It is his responsibility under the law of Moses. It is his responsibility as a man in the land of Israel. And he will not fulfill his responsibility. And so he is labeled with this, the man who will not do his duty. Now the question then becomes, folks, right? What in any possible world does this have to do with polygamy? And the answer to that is, it becomes a little more questionable, right? Because here's what we don't know. Does the man have an existing wife? Now, I would argue that if that was a legitimate exclusion, it would have been mentioned. Right? Some of the literature that you read, if you went to read it, will just automatically out of the gate go, well, if he already had a wife, can't have another wife. But that's not true in the Old Testament. You can have another wife. So what we have here is a potential situation in which you could be mandated. Obviously, this is going to be a fairly rare occurrence. But it is possible, I think, folks, that under the Old Testament, in part of fulfilling the law of Moses, you would be required to have two wives. And that I would turn you then back to the chapter passage in Exodus, which says both wives have to be treated equally under the law. And you can't. Yes, sir. Right. If she's a widow and there is no brother? No, it does not. No, it does not. No, I think in that case, then there is. There was a near kinsman. Yes, there was a near kinsman, but there was no legal obligation for him to marry her. But when he did want to marry her, he had to follow the process of going to the next nearest kinsman, right? Because there was a kinsman that was closer. Right. So I don't know specifically, Paul. You could go to the passage in Ruth, right? And so you could try to build the case there, right? And it's entirely possible that the woman simply remained widowed and the line did go out because that there just wasn't any other alternative to that. That they could, and right, and obviously that's what I was getting ready to say. And then you have the situation with the daughters of Zelophehad who went, well, we don't have a male heir. What happens to us? And God said, well, what happens to you is you get the land. Right?
I didn't know if that would play in. Obviously,
it, I did not read anything specifically about that. Now, I did not read, okay? I mean, I was reading pretty much confined to this passage, and I didn't read anybody that brought it in. I didn't look at, and I'm going to guess it's out there, a body of literature on all the marital customs as pertained to Israel. When we get into these kinds of things, folks, and one of the reasons I wanted to tackle is, when you get into these kind of passages in the Law of Moses, you realize how complicated, right? I mean, we tend to go Ten Commandments, cut and dried, black and white, simple, easy peasy, but when you start to get into these, right? Even under the law, they were not always incredibly simple decisions to make. And there are just a variety of factors that we just don't understand. So anyway, that's that. And again, the way that it touches on polygamy would be this. It doesn't mandate polygamy, but I think by not providing a specific exclusion, right, here would have been a great, right, because God is kind of going through, if this happens, if this happens, if this happens, then this should happen. Here would have been a perfect time to put, and if there's already an existing wife, then you can't have that. But that doesn't seem to be the way that it is. All right, so that's one issue. Again, and maybe sometime I'll try and do some more extensive work on marriage, under the Law of Moses, because there's a lot of moving parts to it. But I want to move on to the second, and actually there are two questions that I'm going to try and deal with in conjunction together. Okay? Turn now, if you would, to Matthew chapter 25. So I am moving completely in a different direction now to two issues that have come up under the issue of polygamy. And actually one of these came up very early, in our study on the kingdom, and I just kind of set it aside, but it's appropriate to try and tackle it here and to put some light to it here as well. Okay. So here are the two questions in rough form, because they were just the result of conversation. Right. So with reference to polygamy, what about the parable of the 10 virgins? And we're going to read that. And how that would have any light. What about that parable? What about the parable of the 10 virgins? And the second one is this. What do we do about the fact, and this is one I have chewed and chewed and chewed and chewed on this for a long time now. What do we do about the fact that both Israel and the church are called God's wife? When we talk about polygamy, what do we do about the fact that both Israel and the church are called God's wife? Does God have two wives, or are we completely in error in believing that Israel is not the church and the church is not Israel, which would put God in the situation of talking to two distinct groups of people as if they are his bride? And actually, and I don't know that I'm going to have enough time to get into all of it this morning, it actually gets a little more complicated than that. But those are the two questions. So let's begin by just looking at verses 1 through 10 of Matthew 25, and at least coming to a pretty simple understanding of why we would even bring it into the question of polygamy. Right? Then shall the kingdom of heaven be likened unto 10, singular or plural? Plural. Plural in the English, plural in the Greek. 10 virgins. Right? 10 is not singular. You have 10 quantity plural, which took their lamps and went forth to meet the singular, plural, singular, singular in the English, singular in the Greek. And five of them were wise, five were foolish. They were foolish, took their lamps, took no oil with them, but the wise took oil in their lamps, vessels with their lamps. While the bridegroom tarried, they all slumbered and slept, but at midnight there was a cry made, "Behold, the bridegroom cometh, go ye out to meet him." Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said unto the wise, "Give us of your oil, for our lamps are gone out." But the wise answered, saying, "Not so, lest there be not enough for us and you. Go ye rather to them that sell, buy for yourselves." And while they went to buy, the bridegroom, singular, plural, singular, came, and they, singular, plural, plural, they that were ready went with him to the marriage, and the door was shut. So you see why it would touch on polygamy, right? Because what you apparently have here is one bridegroom marrying five women. And off they go. Happy honeymoon. One man, five wives. Five mothers-in-law. Five mothers-in-law. Or five masters, I guess, depends on how you want to, right? But I think, right, we can see the connection. In this parable, right, we have an illustration given from kind of a plural marriage position. We have one bridegroom and we have 10 potential brides. And they're not, right? I mean, it's not like the old movie, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, right? It's one brother and X number of brides. Which to me is similar to this question. What do we do about the fact that God talks about Old Testament Israel as his wife and God talks about the church as his bride? Turn back the Old Testament to Jeremiah chapter 3. And this is only one passage. And again, if you go into Ezekiel chapter 16, which we will look at briefly, but not in any depth. It becomes even more complicated when God talks about Israel as his bride, as his wife, because God recognizes two distinct entities as Israel, Judah and Samaria. And so we could potentially ask the question as to whether God was practicing a form of polygamy even in the Old Testament. Jeremiah chapter 3. Verse number 6. The Lord said also unto me in the days of Josiah the king, "Hast thou seen that which backsliding Israel hath done? She has gone up upon every high mountain and under every green tree, and there hath played the harlot. And I said, after she had done all these things, turn thou unto me, but she returned not. And her treacherous sister Judah saw it. And I saw when for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery, I had put her away." So again, we're kind of posing the question, does God have two wives, Judah and Samaria? And has he divorced Samaria? "I had put her away, given her a bill of divorcement," get a divorce. "Yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also. And it came to pass through the lightness of her whoredom that she defiled the land and committed adultery with stones and with stocks. And yet for all this her treacherous sister Judah hath not turned unto me with her whole heart, but feignedly, saith the Lord." Now this, by the way, right, this scenario and this lament is developed and expanded upon in greater length in Ezekiel chapter 16, which God kind of talks about the entire history of finding that nation, and he makes that comparison again, right? For all that God did to Samaria, and he just desecrated Samaria very quickly. And the Assyrians came in and carried them away, and they were gone. They were gone from their land. They were gone from their home. They went out of existence right about 720 BC. They are gone. And yet Judah continues for about the next 140 years in apparent oblivion to what God had done to Samaria. So that when you get to Jeremiah's day, you don't really have any Samaritans in Jeremiah's book. They're all inhabitants of Judah. They're all the remnant. And they're all saying the same thing. God's not going to deal with us harshly. He's made a covenant with us. He's not going to deal harshly with us. And so you have this kind of lament, and you have it again in Ezekiel chapter number 16. So the Old Testament, and I'm just reading that passage, folks, just right to reinforce this point, that the Old Testament calls Israel collectively God's wife. He treats them as a wife. And in Revelation chapter 21, right? Revelation 21:9, you don't need to turn to it. Let me just read to you. There came to me one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials for the last seven last plagues, and talked with me, saying, come hither, I will show thee the bride, the Lamb's wife. And Paul said to the Corinthians, I have espoused you to God. I have betrothed you to God. So when we talk about polygamy, plural marriage, in a physical sense, one man having two wives, one wife having two husbands, we find that kind of language used in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. Here's, I think, the best way that we should think about that kind of language. That it is a metaphor, one of many metaphors that God uses to describe His relationship to His people. Right, for instance, if we insist that it is literally a marriage, then we ask the question, is God married to Samaria or is God married to Judah? Or is God married to both? And then that raises a whole host of questions, because if God really endorses polygamy, why do we have Adam and Eve? Why do we have the New Testament pattern of one man, one wife? Why are we not continuing to practice polygamy today? You go, well, that would be weird. But folks, if we had grown up being taught and believing that polygamy was what God wanted, it wouldn't be that weird to us. Right? If our entire culture was saturated with the notion that polygamy was what God wanted, it really wouldn't read that weird. I'm not saying everybody would love it. I'm just saying that we would accept it as something that happens. So, and if it is a marriage in literal sense, right? If God is not a polygamist in the Old Testament with Samaria and Israel, is He a polygamist in the broader context of Israel and the church? And excuse me for a moment at just being on the borderline of the edge, or maybe even a little bit over the edge. If God is literally our husband, where does that leave those of us who are men? I mean, we can't go there. We can't go that God's going to marry a man. So, right? I think when we read those things, we want to take them at face value. We're Bible literalists, but we also recognize that God uses symbolic and metaphorical language to describe His relationship with His people. And there are actually a variety of expressions that God uses to describe His relationship with His people. Let me just list them. I'm looking at the clock here. Let me just list them for you rather than have you take the time to turn to all of them. Exodus chapter 4, verse number 22, Israel is God's son. Thou shalt say unto Pharaoh, thus saith the Lord, Israel is my son, even my firstborn. And I say unto thee, Exodus 4:23, let my son go, that he may serve thee. And if thou refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay thy son, even thy firstborn. So there's the context for the Passover. Why did God kill the oldest son in the house of Egypt? Because Egypt wouldn't let go God's oldest son, Israel. Israel is my son. Secondly, Israel is a kingdom of priests. Exodus 19:6. Ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and an holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel, which we've taught. I've talked about this many times. When Revelation chapter 5 says we shall be kings and priests unto him, it is probably a reference to that passage, Exodus 19:6, that we will be a kingdom of priests. So again, folks, right, we understand that there is symbolic, metaphorical expression here. What was Israel in the Old Testament? It was God's son. It was a kingdom of priests. It was God's vineyard, Isaiah chapter 5, verses 1 through 7. It is God's vineyard. I took care of the vineyard and I planted grapes in the vineyard. Number 4, Israel is God's servant. And we find these servant song passages in the book of Isaiah. And many of them are describing Jesus ultimately as the servant. But let me read to you Isaiah 45. This is with reference to King Cyrus, the man who had issued the decree for Israel to go back to the land. For Jacob my servant's sake and Israel mine elect, I have even called thee by thy name. I have surnamed thee, though thou hast not known me. I am the Lord, there is none else, there is no God beside me. I girded thee, though thou hast not known me, that thou may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is none beside me. I am the Lord, and there is none else. For Jacob my servant's sake. This is national Israel. Israel is my servant. So Israel is God's son, and Israel is God's kingdom, and Israel is God's servant, and Israel is God's flock. Psalm 78:52, many passages, right? The entirety of the 23rd Psalm, the Lord is my shepherd. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture. In the New Testament, there are a variety of ways that God describes our relationship with him. John chapter 15, he is the vine, we are the branches. And again, folks, we believe our Bibles literally. We believe them to be the inspired word of God. We acknowledge them for their authority. We believe them to be truthful. But none of us really believe that we're made of wood, and that what flows through our veins is sap. We understand we have a metaphorical expression to describe our life-giving relationship. He is the head and we are the body, Ephesians 1, Colossians 1. He is the husband, we are the wife, Ephesians 5. Right? The great mystery of marriage is not how to have a happy marriage, but why we have a marriage at all. Because of the relationship that we have with the Lord. How do we know, right, that we should think of these kinds of expressions primarily in metaphorical terms? Well, let me add this to the marriage mix. Right? In the Old Testament, Israel was God's wife, and in the New Testament, we're the bride of Christ. But then you have to add this in, folks. Matthew 22:30, for in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels of God in heaven. For when they shall rise from the dead, they shall neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels which are in heaven. Mark 12:25. Every one of the Gospels, well, every one of the Synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, tell us this same thing. Luke 20:35, that they which shall be accounted worthy to obtain that world and the resurrection from the dead, neither marry nor are given in marriage. Now, we understand that at one level, we're not given in marriage to each other. Right? My marriage will not endure on the other side. Your marriage will not endure on the other side. And again, right, does that mean, Right? Because the church is designated as the bride of Christ. What does that mean, right? How does that work, right? We have this language that we are living stones in God's temple, that we are individual cells in this body that God is building. What will that do ultimately to our gender identity? Will we stop being men and women? Will we all take on some spiritualized form of femininity? I think that we got to be careful, folks, about pressing these metaphors too far. Why a marriage metaphor? Let me just give you a couple of reasons why a marriage metaphor. Number one, it expresses the relationship of intimacy. The way that it is supposed to work, folks, is that the only relationship that is that intimate is a marriage relationship. Now, we live in a world in which sexual immorality is the norm and celebrated. But biblically, right, that level of intimacy belongs only to a husband and wife with each other. And since God looks at it from that perspective, right, this is what he is bringing into that metaphor. As he said to Israel in Amos 3:2, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. Well, God certainly knew about the Babylonians and the Assyrians and the Egyptians. But there was a level of intimacy only with Israel. Only they were chosen. And by the way, let me just finish the verse. You only have I known of all the families of the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for all your iniquities. Right? So it is that language is used because that level of intimacy exists. And it also emphasizes what is supposed to be the fidelity of that relationship. Right? Not only is a marriage designed to be an intimate relationship, it is designed to be a faithful, intimate relationship. In God's economy, marriage is not only monogamous, it is mentally and emotionally monogamous. I'm going to read the verse, men, and every one of us will want to hide under the pew. Here's the level of standard, right? When every Sunday morning when I preach to Westwood Heights Baptist Church, when virtually every pastor preaches to his congregation, he is looking for the most part out at an assembly of people who are incredibly faithful to their spouses from the world's standpoint. But here is the Lord's standpoint. Here's the way the Lord sees things. You have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. That level of fidelity is the requirement. That level of fidelity is what is demanded. By the way, that level of fidelity is what God gives. God does not look at people who are not his and go, boy, I wish I could have them instead of you. And this is why, folks, so many times when God is discussing our unfaithfulness, he is discussing it in infidelity terms. Right? What did Israel do? Went out and played the harlot. And in fact, again, when you get into Ezekiel chapter 16, God laments. I mean, Ezekiel 16, folks, is one of the most graphic passages in the Old Testament. And God's lament in Ezekiel chapter 16 is that Judah didn't even have the decency to sell herself as a prostitute, but just gave herself away to everybody that came along. Or as it is put in James 4:4, ye adulterers and adulteresses, right, guys and girls, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. So Will there be a literal marriage ceremony where we are all somehow melded into the physical wife of God? I don't think that that's the picture that's ultimately being painted, but that we have a metaphor for that kind of intimate spiritual relationship with the Lord. Okay, happy to talk with you. Please, again, email me, write out,